From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The 112th Congress convened earlier this week in Washington, with a House controlled by the GOP and a slimmer Democratic majority in the Senate. Today, we spend the entire hour with Iowa Senator Tom Harkin. The five-term Democratic senator will give us his view of how the new Congress will operate differently than the old. Harkin is calling for an end to the way filibusters are used and a change in the way for-profit colleges do business. He's also fending off Republican efforts to repeal the new health care law. We'll discuss these and other issues this hour, along with your questions. Senator Tom Harkin, live on The Exchange, right after this news. And this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week in Washington, the 112th Congress convened with a House controlled by the GOP now and a slimmer Democratic majority in the Senate. Today, we spend the entire hour with Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, who joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Senator Harkin. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Ben. Good to be with you. Sorry I'm missing you up here in Des Moines. Have you got snow down there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in Iowa City, we have snow as well. So back to the white stuff.
Actually, as long as it doesn't get any worse than this.
Okay. We're good. It's certainly pretty. Exchange listeners, we want to hear from you this hour with your questions, comments, and concerns for Senator Harkin. What do you think should be the top priority for this, the new Congress, the 112th? What do you think of efforts by the GOP to repeal the new health care law? And do you think the Senate needs to change the way it does business and put an end to the way filibusters are used? Some of the topics we'll be talking about this hour, 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Senator Harkin, when the new Congress convened in Washington earlier this week, you were one of the first speakers on the floor of the Senate. You and fellow Democrats offered a proposal to end the controversial Senate tradition of the filibuster, which in effect requires 60 votes for any bill to pass. Now, minority Republicans in the Senate argue the filibuster protects the rights of the minority, that it prevents the tyranny of the majority, and they say it's brazen for majority Democrats to propose the rule change. Sounds a little bit like, could be interpreted as, hey, I don't like the way the game is going, so let's change the rules. Why do you propose this change?
First of all, keep one thing in mind. I first proposed this in 1995, 15, 16 years ago, when I was in the minority. So I come to this with clean hands. I said in 1995, after the Republicans had taken over both the House and the Senate, I said at the time that the place is getting dysfunctional. This filibuster thing has gotten out of hand. And I said we're in an arms race in which one minority will use it. And then when the next majority becomes the minority the next time, they use it even more. And it just escalates up and up and up. And I said that 16 years ago. I'm sad to say it became true. The Republicans were in charge then. Then the Democrats became in charge. Then the Republicans got in charge. Then the Democrats got in charge. And every time it changed, it got worse, to the point where in the last 4 years we've had over 275 filibusters. Keep in mind, during the previous almost 70 years, going back to 1917, for 70 years we had less than 50 during that whole time. We had 275 in the last couple, 3 years, 136 last year alone. I've said before, it's not the filibuster, it's what the filibuster has become. You know, you have rules, and people supposedly abide by those rules, but rules can be twisted. And what's happened is the old filibuster rules have been twisted to the point where, you know, this whole idea of Mr. Smith goes to Washington and he stands on the Senate floor and he talks and talks and kills legislation, that doesn't happen. And a filibuster today, you don't even have to be on the floor. All you have to do is threaten a filibuster.
In fact, and then you, go ahead.
Well, and then you put in quorum calls and no one shows up and you just slow everything down and you stop things. let me just respond. We're clicking with this, man. The way the system has evolved in the Senate right now, 41 senators, a minority, has the absolute total veto power over any legislation. Now, that might strike some as odd. I mean, 41 out of a minority has the right to dictate things. I thought we believed in democracy, the majority rule, with respect for the minority, respect for minority rights. The minority should have the right to debate and discuss and amend. But should the minority have the absolute power to stop everything? That puts our Constitution on its head.
In fact, in going back to your earlier reference, in a nod to that classic movie that you mentioned, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, your colleague, Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, reintroduced his Mr. Smith bill, and that would require those who want to filibuster a nomination or a bill to actually appear on the floor and speak. Here's a little bit from that 1939 movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. This is the part, Senator, where Jimmy Stewart plays Senator Jefferson Smith. Here he takes the floor of the Senate to oppose a corrupt bill and is so exhausted he eventually collapses.
You all think I'm licked. Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause, even if this room gets filled with lies like these. And the tailors and all their armies come marching into this place. Somebody will listen to me.
Now, Senator, we've all grown up thinking the filibuster was heroic and as American as Jimmy Stewart, and you're telling us now, because of partisan politics, it's not?
Well, I don't even know if it's – well, partisan politics has led to it, but it's more that a few senators have found that they can exercise this power and stop everything. For example, we had a – I recently had a bill that I reported out of my committee, the food safety bill. No dissenting votes. It was supported, broad coalition support for everything from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the U.S. Public Interest Research Groups to the Consumers Union, grocery manufacturers. Everyone wanted a new food safety bill. Business wanted it because they wanted to be protected from lawsuits and things like that. They wanted to have safer food. They wanted to have better inspections. And, of course, consumers because people getting sick all the time. So anyway, we had this bill. But one senator kept me from bringing it on the floor for almost a year. And when we finally did bring it on the floor, we had to have it on the floor for a long period of time, even though it was voted. I think we got 76 votes for it, I think. Mm-hmm. 76 votes. And then it went. There was a little problem in it, went to the House. They fixed the problem, sent it back, and that same senator would not let us bring it up. So that's the power of one senator, and that is an abuse of the filibuster. That's what the filibuster has become. It has become a tool that one or two or three senators can use to just veto, stop everything.
With this rule change, the Senate could pass legislation with a simple majority, 51 votes, I believe. What do you see as the most pressing legislation currently being held up by the current filibuster rules that would change if this rule change goes through?
Well, there's a number of them. Jobs and the economy, we'll be working on that. Let me just give you an example of one bill that was stopped, vetoed by the minority, that I think the American people supported broadly. It was called the Disclose Act. As you know, the Supreme Court about a year ago decided that, under the Citizens United case, that certain entities did not have to disclose who was giving them money. And so in this last election, we had just a huge amount of money spent on ads and things by outside groups, but they don't have to tell where they get the money. We fixed that with a bill. It didn't say you couldn't give them money that they couldn't get. We just wanted to say you have to disclose who's giving you the money. Well, it passed the House, came to the Senate, I think two or three times we tried to pass it, and each time it was killed by the minority. And yet all polls show that 80% or more of the American people, including Republicans, thought that this was a good idea, at least to disclose who's put the money in there. But because of the filibuster, we were not able to do it.
1-866-780-9100. Your comments, questions, concerns for Senator Harkin, who is good enough to join us for the entire hour live on the Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio. Let's go to Iowa City. Kirk is with us. Good afternoon, Kirk. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead, Kirk. What's on your mind?
Well, my question was on why bills have to be so scattered. You know, like the health care bill should have been all about health care and shouldn't have, just for the example that wasn't in there, a bridge to nowhere in Alaska, you know, and that sort of thing. And why is every bill so packed full of stuff that isn't essential to that bill? Why can't we just have it be a two-page thing saying, area's health care, go?
Right, health care, again, 2,000 pages. So, Senator Harkin, why are these bills often laden with unrelated things, and can that be fixed?
Yes, it can be. Just two thoughts. First of all, that bridge to nowhere in Alaska was in the transportation bill. It was in the transportation. It wasn't in a health care bill. It was in a transportation bill several years ago. And I would say most of the time, most bills are pretty clean when they come out of committee in terms of what's in the bill and what it pertains to. And I would say, again, one of the problems we have with the present setup of the filibuster is, let's say that one senator or two or three, they're not going to let the bill come up. And so you go to them and say, well, look, we got to get this bill. It's widely supported. Well, they got something else they want to bring up, but they can't. So if you just put it on that bill, then I'll let it go. Again, that's an abuse of the system.
Now,
and it leads to all kinds of mischief, by the way.
Senator Chuck Grassley is against this rule change, saying it would it protects the rights of the minority. He differs there with that on you, but he seems to be arguing with you for a related rule. I'd like to have you explain a change to this ban on so-called secret holds, which allows senators to block legislation anonymously. You can stop something in its tracks and not even show your face, right?
That's right. As long as your minority leader will protect you on it. See, what happens is a senator will go to the minority leader and say, I don't want that bill to move, but I don't want to be known on it. So the minority leader then goes to the majority leader and says, don't bring up that bill. I've got a hold on it. And they don't tell you who the hold is. And so, you know, taking away secret holds. But again, I got to tell you, that's not really going to do much.
Will that be changed?
Probably will be changed, but it won't do much. I mean, a lot of the senators I know who put holds on bills are proud to say that they're supporting a hold on a bill, and there are ways around that. Well, let me give you an example. The minority leader goes, let's say this thing passes and says you can't put secret holds, you got to list your name and stuff like that if you put a hold on a bill. Okay, you got that passed. Minority leader now goes to majority leader and says, you know that bill you want to bring up, I don't have any holds on it, but I have two senators who each want to speak for 20 hours. And so the majority leader said, well, who are they? And he said, well, I can't tell you. Well, the majority leader says, well, all right, we'll give 20 hours in a debate. Minority leader comes back after a bit and says, oh, I found two more senators, and they want an additional 50 hours of debate. And this could be just a minor, non-controversial bill. But there's nothing there that says that they got to tell them who they are. So you see, there's all kinds of ways around these rules. That's why I say that the best way to do it is to provide, and this is where I differ with Senator Grassley on this. I believe in the minority should have rights, but I do not believe that under our system of government, under democracy, that a minority should be able to absolutely veto something and block something. They ought to be able to slow it down. They should have the right to amend, debate, discuss, but in the end, the majority ought to have the right to pass something. I mean, just take a city council. What if you have a city council of seven people? Well, do you think three people ought to be able to decide what that city council does?
Is this what's holding up also the judicial nominees that are in the news as well?
That's why we have all these judicial nominees backed up. We had a judge last year, Ben, that was, I forget her name, a Fourth Circuit, wasn't in our circuit, was held up for almost 9 months. And when we finally got it up, she passed 99-0. So why was it held up for 9 months?
Why was it?
Well, because People wanted to slow things down, to plug things up, so we couldn't bring something else up. I had a person that I put through my committee. It was an Obama nominee. It was a lower-ranking position. It was a solicitor for the Department of Labor. Woman from New York, had a sterling background, had been, I think, a solicitor for the state of New York. But there were a couple, three senators who, because of a couple of decisions she had made, didn't like her. Well, so I had my hearings in my committee. We put her through the committee, had our votes in committee, brought her to the floor, filed cloture because she was being filibustered. This took several weeks. Finally got a vote. We got 60 votes for cloture. But then there's 30 hours under the rules. If you invoke cloture, there's 30 more hours that you can burn up. Well, we asked that the 30 hours be done away with. The minority objected. And the only person to speak on her was one senator came down and spoke for about 15 minutes. And for 29 hours and 45 minutes, I had to sit on the Senate floor and do nothing. And do nothing. I mean, she'd already passed. They just got 30 hours, and so they didn't want to, as they say, yield it back or to let us do anything else. So for 29 hours and 45 minutes, which took me the better part of almost 3 days, I just had to sit there with nothing to do.
Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, our guest this hour on The Exchange. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, or a concern for Senator Harkin, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, or email on Twitter at IPRTalk. 94 new House members sworn in on Wednesday, Senator. 13 new senators sworn in. The new House has the largest freshman class with no experience in elected office since 1948. Republicans now hold a 242-193 majority in the House. Democrats still holding on to the Senate, 53-47, including two Democrats or two independents who caucus with the Democrats. How do things change with so many new people in Congress?
Well, Ben, I've been there through a lot of changes. My gosh, I was there during the Gingrich Revolution, as I said, in the 90s when all that new group came into the House.
And how does this measure up to that change from what you can tell?
Don't know yet. I will say this, that at that time, Gingrich was the leader of the revolution, and he became Speaker. In this case, John Boehner, who is the new Speaker, was sort of – he's not a leader of the revolution. This is not a Tea Party person. I've known John Boehner for many years. I've worked with him on the education – he's been on the Education Committee in the House, and so I go back 20-some years working with John Boehner. Very reasonable, conservative, but willing to work things out. And so I think there's a difference there. In terms of the leadership of the House.
Is the entrance of these many Tea Party members noticeable in Congress to you?
Don't know yet. We just got sworn in, so it's hard to say.
Do you reach out to new colleagues when they come in these first weeks as a rule?
Oh, sure. Well, see, first of all, committee assignments I don't think have been made yet on the House side, so that's usually when you start associating with people is when you find out who's on your committee, and then you – go over and introduce yourself and start talking about this and that. But in the Senate, since there's only 100 of us, it's much more collegial. And I think I've already said hello to most of the new senators, I think, by now. And some of them I knew before. Rob Portman, who came in from Ohio, gosh, I've known him for a long time. And Dan Coats from Indiana. I served with him in the Senate. Dan was in the Senate with us, and then he left, and then he came back again. Mark Kirk from Illinois, my gosh, I've done work with Mark for years. He was on the House Appropriations Committee, and I was on the Senate, so I've known him for a long time. Well, so there's a lot of people I've known who've been in and out of government in the past that are on the Republican side that came in this time. Some of them are new that I don't know, but we'll get to know them.
Senator Harkin, a number of people wanting to speak with us by phone, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Dubuque. Dean is joining us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Dean. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, and good afternoon, Senator Harkin. My wife and I are senior citizens, and we find that Social Security is a very important source of income for us. And as you know, we haven't received a cost of living increase last year, and we're not going to receive one this year. But the reality for us is that our natural gas has gone up 11%. Our electricity has gone up 17%. Our property taxes have gone up 5%. We're paying a lot more for food in the grocery stores than we did 2 years ago. Gasoline has gone up. And is there any way to amend or change Social Security or give us a shot in the arm to help us deal with these increases in cost of living for us that we don't really have any income to pay for?
Thank you, Dean. Senator Harkin.
Well, Dean, you're absolutely right. We tried last year, I think it was Senator Sanders, I believe, had that had the amendment in to give at least a one-time bump up in Social Security payments. I'm sorry, I'm sitting here, I'm trying to remember what it was. I think it was $250 to Social Security recipients around the country. Now, the reason I liked that was for the very reasons, Dean, you just mentioned, but also because when you do $250, $250 is worth a lot more to a lower-income person who doesn't get a lot of Social Security than it is to some higher-income person. So I thought that was a good approach, but we didn't have the votes to pass it. We didn't have the votes to overcome, get this, a filibuster.
Mm. And,
so
and
filibustered, and we had over 50 votes. See, here again, where I'd love to debate this with Senator Grassley, who's a great friend of mine, and I was honored to walk him down the aisle for his swearing-in the other day, but these are good debates, and we should have these public debates. I'd love to have this debate with Senator Grassley. Why shouldn't, if there were over 50% that wanted the 250, why shouldn't the majority have had the right to vote on that and to pass it? But because they've set this bar at 60 votes, you now need a supermajority to pass anything in the United States Senate. It's as I said, this stands the Constitution on its head. Well, but anyway, Dean, we're going to be trying that again this year because you're absolutely right, especially for senior citizens on fixed incomes. These energy prices going up are really tough.
Well, we have to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Senator Tom Harkin joining us for the entire hour with us as we mark the first week of the 112th Congress convened, a House now controlled by the GOP, a slimmer Democratic majority in the Senate. And when we come back, we want to talk about health care. It's been 10 months since the Democrats' health legislation was signed into law, and before most of its major elements have been implemented, the House, now under Republican rule, plans to vote to repeal what is known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We'd like your input on that when we come back. We'll ask Senator Harkin about the chances of that repeal as it reaches, if it reaches, the Senate. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. What do you or don't you like about the new health care law? Let Senator Harkin know. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Back with Senator Tom Harkin here on The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio in just a few moments. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Senator Tom Harkin is with us, Democrat Tom Harkin, for the entire hour. First elected to the Senate in 1984 after serving 10 years in the U.S. House. He's serving his fifth term in the Senate after being reelected in 2008. Interesting tidbit here, Senator Harkin, that you are the longest serving junior senator in the Senate. Is that correct?
Well, now, wait a second. This is a new one on me.
No, really?
Is that – well, that could be true. Well, you know, I'll have to look at that because the record was held by Fritz Hollings for a long time from mm-hmm. South Carolina. Strom Thurmond had been the senior senator forever, but maybe I've now broken his record. I don't know. That could be true.
We'll
I've been
the
junior senator now for, what, 26 years now.
We'll have to confirm that, look into that. Let's talk a little bit about...
I bet I'm either first or second.
you're up there in any case, if not number
right,
one.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about health care, the new health care law. It's been 10 months since the Democrats' health legislation was signed into law back in March of the past year. Before all of its major elements have been implemented, the House, now under Republican rule, plans to vote to repeal what is officially called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We know it as... the new health care law, also called Obamacare by its detractors. And you, Senator Harkin, as chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, played a pivotal role in this bill's passage. How concerned are you now that this is the beginning of the end, that this will unravel this health care law?
Well, I think the Republicans in the House will vote next Wednesday to repeal it. But I don't think that's going to go very far, although I'm glad they're doing it. I'm glad that they are showing their colors and that they're going to have a vote on this. That's the way democracy ought to work. I have no problems with that. But I think when people realize what would happen if it were to be repealed. Now, first of all, this new group came into the House saying that they wanted to reduce the deficit. And they one of the rules they put in place was that if a bill came on the floor – that raised spending, it had to be cut someplace else, except for health care. They carved that out because by repealing health care, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says it will cost the taxpayers in more spending about $830 billion in the next 10 years. And over $1 trillion in the 10 years to follow. That's what few people know, is that this health care bill saves us a lot of money.
So why all the negativity in polls we're hearing?
Because I don't think change comes by hard, and there's been so much misinformation put out about this health care bill. I mean, there are still a significant number of people out there that believe there are death panels that Sarah Palin talked about set up under the health care bill. There's just so much misinformation put out, goaded by the health insurance industry, who didn't want to see these changes. But look what would happen in Iowa. For example, if that repeal were to go through, just think what would happen. 8,000 young adults would lose their insurance coverage through their parents' health plans. I mean, not next year. I mean, like now. Because right now, young people can stay in their parents' plans until they're age 26. Nearly 1.9 million residents of Iowa would find themselves once again vulnerable to having lifetime limits. We took that off. Beginning right now, beginning of this year, no longer can insurance companies put a lifetime limit on what you can get. So 1.9 million residents of Iowa would find themselves vulnerable to that. Again, about 171,000 people in Iowa would risk losing their insurance because of insurance underwriting that says that they can cancel your policy if you get sick or if you make a mistake on your application. Well, we took that away too. We have, for the elderly, right now, beginning this year, if you're an elderly person on Social Security, Medicare, and you fall into that donut hole, and if you want me, I can explain that. You fall in that donut hole, you will now get 50% of your Medicare drugs paid for. So you only have to come up with 50% of the cost while you're in that donut hole. That is a significant savings to the elderly in Iowa. And so all those things would go by the wayside if they repeal this health care bill.
Barbara writes in an email, "I'm sorry we can't have a single-payer plan for health care. Regarding the Medicare drug program, you do your best to pick the policy that covers your current drugs, but can't know what new ones you might need in the next 12 months. We need to take the profit out of health care." An email from Barbara. And I wanted to go back to other legislation that was passed by the 111th Congress after the shellacking that Democrats, President Obama's word there, the shellacking that Democrats suffered in November. The legislative accomplishments were anything but lame in this lame duck session. Even some of the president's adversaries acknowledged his successes. We had the extension of tax cuts, ratification of a nuclear arms reduction treaty with Russia, that in the Senate, repeal of the ban on openly gay troops, don't ask, don't tell. The 111th has been described as one of the most productive Congresses in American history. How would you assess the session, and will that bipartisan cooperation continue?
Well, I don't know. I think we did some significant things in the last Congress, obviously the health care reform bill being the big one, the food safety bill that we've been working on for, 15 years we finally got done, a bill that I first started working on with a Republican senator, Senator Chafee, who has since passed away, to give the FDA control over tobacco. We got that done, too. I got my child nutrition bill through, which is going to take all sugared drinks out of our high schools, middle schools, grade schools. I think that anytime you have anywhere you have a school lunch program, they're going to have to get rid of all these sugared drinks and get more nutritious foods in, more fruits and vegetables into our schools. That was in the bill just signed last month by President Obama. And I mentioned the food safety bill that we passed. So there's a lot of good things that we got done.
Will the 112th, though, be as productive as the 111th in your view?
Well, I don't know. And for this reason, Ben, one senator who has been really one of the ones who've tried to hold things up has been Senator DeMint from South Carolina. He said publicly just a few months ago that his main objective in this new Congress was, quote, total gridlock. Total gridlock. Now, I don't know if he means that. He's never said he didn't mean it. And if he does, and if he's got help from a couple of other senators, we could face some paralysis. Now, again, I tell you, I'm working as chairman of the Education Committee to get a new elementary and secondary education reauthorization bill out, which will basically modify the No Child Left Behind bill. I've got good Republican support, and I'm working closely with the Republicans on my committee on it. But, you know, we could get a good bill through our committee, but if we have some people on the floor that want to have gridlock, well, I just don't know what's going to happen. Even Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that his objective in this next Congress was to make Obama a one-term president. Well, if that's the attitude you go in with, then I don't know if we're going to be productive or not. I hope those are just political rhetoric. If that's all it is political rhetoric, what the heck, I could care less. But I think we'll see in the first 6 months or so of this new year whether or not we can actually work together to get some things done.
Frank is joining us. Sorry, Senator.
I hope so. Well, I hope so because we got to get jobs back, and we got to get our economy going again. And no one party has a monopoly on that. We're going to have to work together on that one.
Now, speaking of jobs, some good news on the employment front today. Businesses stepped up hiring in December, we learned, adding a net total of just over 100,000 jobs during the month. December job gains, enough to drive down the unemployment rate to 9.4. It was previously 9.8. In November. This marks the largest one-month decline in the nation's unemployment rate since April of 98. So the term jobless recovery has been thrown around a lot, Senator. Do you think we're now out of the bottom of the trough of unemployment?
Well, again, all I can say to that, Ben, is I sure hope so. Mm-hmm. And I sure hope that we don't fall back into it by doing unwise policies in this Congress, like repealing the health care bill. I think if we repeal the health care bill, you're going to see those numbers turn around.
But the opposition is saying the health care law is a job killer. How are we to understand? What is it, a job creator or a job killer?
Well, to the extent that it is reducing government expenditures, which the CBO says it does, over $800 billion in this next decade, that puts us on a sounder fiscal footing. I also believe that by instituting some of the reforms that we have in the health care bill, that that it's just going to save us money. I don't think it's going to cost us jobs. I'm not certain that the health care bill is going to create jobs, but it certainly isn't going to cost us any jobs. What it's going to do is save us a lot of money and make us healthier as a nation, because we got all these preventative measures in there now for prevention and wellness.
Steve in Clear Lake is on the line. He wants to talk about jobs. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ben and Senator Harkin. Ben, appreciate the show. And Senator Harkin, thank you for your years of service. My question is about jobs. My employer, within the next 6 months, will be laying off the last of us. I'm one of about 500 people whose jobs are going to Mexico.
Maybe we ask what company that is.
Cummins Filtration in Lake Mills, Iowa.
Sorry to hear that, Steve.
Well, you know, it's kind of it's been a tough time for everybody up there. But my question is, you know, we hear about job creation and job growth, but we hear nothing about job retention in the United States. With all the jobs going to Mexico and China, can you explain, Senator Harkin, what we're doing to retain jobs here in the States?
Steve, thank you from Clear Lake.
Well, Steve, I don't know that I have an adequate answer for you. I really let me just give you a couple of thoughts that I've had for some time on this. And that is, you have to ask the question, why is this company moving its jobs to Mexico? And you have to ask, okay, what are the factors that go into that? We know that our workforce is one of the most productive in the world. In fact, I think we are the most productive. We have more output per man hour in this country than any other country in the world, certainly a lot more than Mexico. So it can't be production. Is it some and quality? We are very good on quality in this country. So what is it? And then we need to look at, you know, okay, is it what cost factors go into that? But you see, when a company can take jobs and move to a country where they have no EPA regulations, they have no environmental laws that they have to abide by, where they don't have work safety laws, where they don't have a Social Security system to help take care of people with a social safety net, and where they don't have any kind of basic labor laws and minimum wage laws and things like that, well, they can get that done so much cheaper in the other country and then ship it back into this country. That's why I argued a long time ago when they passed the North American Free Trade Act. I said at that time there ought to be two things in that that were not in it. One is some protections for environmental. In other words, if jobs are going there, they have to meet the same kind of environmental standards that we do. You know, we're not that far apart, and we share the same hemisphere here. And secondly, that there should be some kind of a tariff or a balance depending upon what their wage rates are compared to ours. Some labor protections for, you know, as I said, Social Security, the social safety net, worker protections, things like that, that can kind of, you can kind of figure in sort of what that adds to the cost of employment in this country. And then you just say, well, you know, these are the standards we have in this country. If you want to make them in another country, you can go ahead and do it. But we're not going to let you take advantage of lower environmental conditions and lower job conditions and then ship it back into this country. And I think that's something that's lacking in our trade laws.
Senator Harkin, we have just a few minutes left winding up the hour with you. Wanted to get to a couple more topics if possible. The debt yesterday, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner warned lawmakers that the national debt could hit the legal limit on borrowing as soon as the end of March. He urged some quick action to avoid a governmental default, talking of a catastrophic economic consequence that would last for decades. The national debt now $13.95 trillion, just $335 billion short of the limit that Congress set last year. Now, Republicans are in control of the House. Their membership now reinforced with new lawmakers vowing to block further borrowing, a top priority of conservatives, especially in the Tea Party movement. Will you vote to increase the debt ceiling? Is that conditional on some sort of plan to balance the budget? That's a big worry, right?
It is. However, you have to pay your debts, and we do have a debt, and I think it was even – I think John Boehner, the new Speaker of the House, said that when it comes to this, we gotta act like adults, and he's right. The United States of America has never defaulted on its bonds since the Revolutionary War. I mean, we never defaulted on those either. Alexander Hamilton, well, that's another story, but we've never defaulted, and that's and it would be a catastrophe if we were to default on these bonds. So I believe that through all of the speeches and all that kind of stuff, I think that Congress, of course, will do the adult thing, mm-hmm. and make sure we're good on our debts. Now, in the future, now listen, now, you know, the Tea Party's not all wrong on this, by the way. In terms that we got to get a better handle on our deficit and on our spending and taxing priorities. Now, where I disagree with them on is that you can erase the deficit simply by reducing spending, and what they're proposing is a 20% cut in all discretionary spending except for the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security, and Veterans Affairs. Well, I don't think the Department of Defense ought to be left out of this. Boy, there's probably more waste, fraud, and abuse in the Department of Defense than anywhere else. And so, and then I think we got to look at revenues too. Some people in this country are overtaxed, but there's a lot of people in this country who are undertaxed. And I mean, corporations, for example, are undertaxed. We got to close down this offshoring of money. There's a lot of things that we could do to raise more revenues in this country.
Before we have to go quickly, you began serving. We were reflecting on how long you've been junior senator. You began serving your term in the Senate when Governor-elect Terry Branstad was serving his first term as governor. This would be in the mid-'80s. How do you see Terry Branstad's leadership affecting the state? A step forward or backward?
Well, I don't know. I always had good relations with Governor Branstad all the time he was governor. In fact, we'd worked together on some things. And then later when he was at Des Moines University, I think I was quite helpful in helping Des Moines University do some things. I like that school. They put out a lot of great family practice doctors in Iowa. Now, again, I congratulate him on his victory, but I think it's too early to tell. I mean, we'll see what he does and how he works with the new legislature. But he's a savvy guy. He's been around a long time, I just hope that we'll work together and hope that he provides the kind of leadership that will pull our state together and keep us moving forward. I think Chet Culver did a very good job as governor. I mean, we end up with $800 million in our surplus. He was great in addressing the floods in eastern Iowa. The Power Fund, we're now one of the leaders in the United States in terms of alternative energy, due in no small part because of Chet Culver. So I hope we continue those. And I want to mention one other thing. I certainly hope that we don't do away with preschool here in Iowa. You know, we've always prided ourselves on education. We took the step forward. In fact, I was instrumental in getting the first countywide preschool in Pottawatomie County. And then we took it statewide. I think that is a mark, should be a source of pride for us. But now I understand the legislature wants to do away with universal preschool and put it on some kind of a voucher basis. I think that is a terrible, terrible step backwards for Iowa.
Quickly, before we have to go, we know Iowa's population is growing, now above 3 million in the last census, but the state's growth not keeping pace with other states. Iowa going to lose a congressional district. Any reflections mm-hmm. on the loss of that? We've gone from seven down to four now, huh?
Well, one time we had 11. So we're down to four now.
I guess I'm talking about my lifetime, maybe.
Okay. You're too young. Okay, but we had 11 at one time, and then seven and down to four. That's too bad. I mean, but it's one person, one vote, and it's going to cause us to lose one member of our House of Representatives, and that's just too bad. Well, again, another good reason why we have a Senate and you have two senators. We get two senators, and so does California. And that's That's why we have a Senate. We don't have a Senate because of a filibuster. We have a Senate because two senators from each state can help balance off all the congressmen from California and Texas and places like that.
Senator Harkin, we want to thank you for this hour of conversation. We can let you go now and go out and play on that fine new snow out there.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ben. Nice being with you.
Senator Tom Harkin with us for the entire hour. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. A good place to go. You want to catch up on prior shows, shows from the past. Also, if you heard part of this hour but want to hear the whole thing, iowapublicradio.org. Look for The Exchange. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.